We're here at the Young Survival Coalition of Central Indiana, and Laura Turner-Jones is making a presentation for podcast, Fat Intake, Menopausal Status, and Risk of Breast Cancer, a Meta-Analysis.
Thank you. Okay, so my research, I'm a PhD student at IU, and my research is now centered around breast cancer and reproductive events in women's lifestyle. And that's going to also focus a lot of around diet. So as an anthropologist, I have a very different view of approaching a problem than a clinical study would. I ask questions that would basically shape the clinical studies. So instead of asking whether or not fat will affect your risk of breast cancer, I say, why would fat initially affect breast cancer? So as a biological anthropologist, we ask questions about reconstructing lifestyle, diet, and reproductive events that would affect our human ancestors. And I apologize, for some reason the slides are a little messed up. That's me. Yes, that is me. That's me at Muncie. So when this problem currently is being approached by observations of non-human primates like apes, hunter-gatherer societies or traditional societies, and to some extent the archaeological and paleontological record. And when we actually compare data and observations between modern hunter-gatherer societies like in Africa and in Asia and women in affluent societies like America, we see striking difference between reproductive events, diet, exercise load, and body composition. And a study in 1994 by Eaton et al. Suggested that these strong differences that we see may be responsible for elevated rates of disease, especially in women. And this would include diseases such as ovarian cancers, endometrial cancers, and of course, breast cancer. And so what they did was they looked at a bunch of different factors, like age at menarche, and what menarche is when you first start your period, age at first birth, the duration between when you start your period and you first have a baby, the duration of lactation, so how long a woman breastfeeds, parity, which means whether or not you have actually had a baby or not, age at menopause, the number of ovulations over an entire life cycle, dietary intake, and then hormonal levels, estrogens, progesterones, all the ones that we're familiar with that are associated with breast cancer. And specifically, they identified these this list here as being elevating risks of breast cancer. And not only did they see that in the modern hunter-gatherer societies and women in affluent nations, but this was also observed in most of the medical research that you're probably more familiar with breast cancer. And so these associations between menarche or your first period, fertility, and lactation comes basically from the hormone estrogen. Now, you're used to hearing it called estrogen, and estrogen is the total concentration of the hormone in a woman's body. However, the actual hormone that we're concerned with as an anthropologist is called estradiol, and that's basically free estrogen in the body. So what happens with fat is as a woman intakes more fat, you can see the little heart where it says circulation, it comes into your circulatory system or your blood, it then affects the brain and then actually releases what's called bound estrogen into the bloodstream. So it uncouples it. And so now it's considered estradiol. So actually what's happening is fat is increasing free estradiol levels. And so when you look at all of these, those factors that I talked about, like age at menopause, age at first birth, etc. And what I did was I sampled a bunch of different modern hunter-gatherer societies and then compared them to women in America. And if you look at them, every single one of them actually increases risk of breast cancer based on a lot of clinical studies that have come out. And they're significantly different. So if you look at this, modern hunter-gatherers actually start their periods at 16.15 years of age, where American women usually start it at 12. Age at first birth, a woman that's in a hunter-gatherer society, usually 19. In America, 24. The duration, so the time in between when you start your period and you have your first baby, usually 2.6 years for a hunter-gatherer, 11.5 for an American. And so the list goes on. So there's these really, really big deviations. And so what I was interested in looking at is whether or not dietary fat intake was also a lot different. And if you look at the percent of dietary fat intake in modern hunter-gatherers, it's 20 grams of fat a day versus Americans that are 36 grams of fat. And that's a really significant difference. And as we, a lot of studies have shown or suggested and hypothesized that the amount of fat that a woman puts on will actually determine when they start their period. So you've heard of, you know, ballerinas don't start their period until really, really late because they have a very, very low body fat percentage. You know, athletes can go into what's called amenorrhea, where they will actually stop ovulating because they have such a low body fat percentage. And so they're thinking, a lot of the scientists are thinking that perhaps because women in America are gaining fat a lot younger in age, they're starting their period longer or earlier in life, and the duration between periods and first births are affecting the probability of breast cancer. So when you look at a bunch of these studies in animals, such as mice, this is supported. The higher the fat intake of the mouse, the higher the probability of mammary carcinogenesis. You feed a mouse a lot of fat, it gets breast cancer. Human studies are not that consistent, and that's what the problem is. So there's a bunch of studies that say if you have a high intake of fat in your diet, you're going to get breast cancer. And then there's some studies that say, well, yes, but only if it's animal fat or dairy fat. And then there are some studies that say there's absolutely no association between dietary fat and breast cancer. But nobody's actually compiled all of these studies and looked at how many say, yes, dietary fat is important, a risk factor in breast cancer, or dietary fat isn't. So that's what I tried to do. The other problem with these studies is they don't compare females in the same way. They don't control for age. Most of them are all done on postmenopausal women. The ones that aren't just done on postmenopausal women, just throw them all together in a big pot and treat postmenopausal women like they're premenopausal women. And then there's a couple of them that look at just premenopausal women. Also, the way they measure fat is not consistent. Some of them use what are called food frequency questionnaires. Some of them use what are called dietary records. Some of them use food histories. So when you compare them, it's difficult to ask whether or not there's a significant difference because they're not, it's like comparing apples and oranges. So the three main questions I asked with my study is, one, is there actually an association between fat intake and breast cancer risk? Two, is there going to be a stronger risk of breast cancer associated with certain types of fat, like total fat intake or monosaturated fats, polyunsaturated fats, saturated fats? And then finally, whether or not these differences are going to be consistent between menopausal statuses. So does a premenopausal woman have the same risk of breast cancer as a postmenopausal woman if they intake fat? And if any of you have any questions while I'm talking, just raise your hand and ask. It's, you know, this is completely informal. Yes. What age group of women did I talk about? I looked at premenopausal women and postmenopausal women. And the problem with the studies that I was looking at is they don't actually say what age. So they don't say like 16 to 25 or, you know, 40 to 50. They just say they've gone through menopause or they have not gone through menopause. And I'm going to address why that's a problem later in the talk. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's higher estrogen and progesterone positive. Yes. So what I did was I did a systematic search on three databases, which are PubMed, Medline, and Embase. So basically, I looked at everything that was published up till November of 2008 that was published on breast cancer and fat intake. Everything. If it's been published, I've got it in this study. And then I did not include any animals. It's only humans. And then I looked at all of these studies, and some of them I could include and some of them I could not. I looked at the number of subjects in each study. I looked at whether they were cohort studies or case control studies, menopausal status, so premenopausal, postmenopausal, or some studies pooled the menopausal statuses together, so they included both pre- and postmenopausal. The way they collected their dietary assessment, like I said, that's a problem. So I only included those studies that used food frequency questionnaires because that was the majority of the study. So it increased the amount of studies I would have. The partitioning of the intakes, it's a way of devising it. So instead of putting women into like high or low, so that would be, you know, two different categories, I chose to use what are called quintiles. So there was five different categories, so a scale from 1 to 5. And that kind of spread everything out, just gave us a better picture. And then I included 4 risk estimates. And those were 4 different types of fat. This was total fat intake, saturated fat intake, monounsaturated fat intake, and polyunsaturated fat intake. And then I also recorded the 95% confidence intervals, which was basically it's a statistical parameter. And I went ahead and I used a software that's called R to do all of my my statistical analyses. So if you're kind of more of a visual person, which I am, this is what I did. I collected a bunch of studies, and then I basically made 4 piles of these studies. Total fat, saturated fat, monounsaturated fat, polyunsaturated fat. Then I took those studies and sectioned them into 2 more piles, which would be cohort and case control studies, and then further sectioned those into premenopausal women and postmenopausal women. Yes, I will in just a minute. I have slides on that. And so my results, I ended up with 57 publishable studies for a total. And this included 1,628,148 cases of breast cancer, and then 46,657 control comparisons. That's a lot. With menopausal status, I ended up with 20 studies. With postmenopausal, 7 studies, boo, on premenopausal, 25 where they combined the menopausal status. And then actually I had to throw 5 away because it wasn't clear whether or not they were only talking about premenopausal or postmenopausal, and I didn't want to get into that. I didn't want it skewing my study, so I just threw them out. These studies come from 22 different countries across the world. So when I looked at everything together, I pulled them all together, premenopausal, postmenopausal, the pooled studies, I take them all together, there was a significant positive association between polyunsaturated fat and relative risk of breast cancer. So what that means is that a woman who had a high polyunsaturated fat diet had a significantly higher risk of contracting breast cancer than any other woman. Total fat, saturated fat, and monounsaturated fat didn't really go either way. It wasn't significant. It didn't really increase your risk. It didn't really decrease your risk. So what I have these numbers up here, RR, so is relative risk. If your RR value is above 1, that means it increases your risk of getting breast cancer. The p-value means it's significant. In statistical studies, anything below 0.5, or I'm sorry, above, or, sorry, below 0.5 or 5% is considered significant. So it is more likely than just chance alone. So what I wanted to ask, though, is there's a bunch of different study types. There's a bunch of different menopausal statuses, and these were taken all over the world. So maybe that's why I was seeing significance. Maybe it really wasn't a big deal. So I ran what's called an ANOVA, which is another statistical test, and it turned out that study type, whether it was a case control study or a cohort study, actually affected my data. So I sectioned them out. So when you look at epidemiological study designs, there's descriptive studies and there's analytical studies. And for what I'm talking about, we're really only concerned with analytical studies, specifically observational studies. observational studies come in two different flavors, case control and cohort studies. In a case control study, you have a big study population of women who, in this case women, who have said that they would like to participate in the study. You section those out between cases of breast cancer and controls, women who don't have breast cancer. And then those are further sectioned out by exposed women and non-exposed women. So that would could be considered anything from you might have a genetic history of breast cancer, or you may be eating a lot of fat, which may be contributing to your risk of breast cancer, etc. In a cohort study, you have the initial study population, which is then subdivided into exposed and non-exposed. Those exposed and non-exposed, so for example, maybe you have the BRCA1 gene, or you have the HER2 gene. Those are then divided further into someone who does have the disease, someone who does have breast cancer, and someone who does not get breast cancer. So that's what the difference is. So when I sectioned them out and I only looked at cohort studies, I kind of saw the same thing that I saw when I pulled them all together. There was a significant positive correlation between polyunsaturated fat and relative risk of breast cancer. So if you look at the difference between the numbers, the relative risk, your risk went up a little bit if it was only a cohort study, and the p-value was pretty much the same. So no difference. So what kind of fat is polyunsaturated fat? What kind of fat would you find food that's polyunsaturated fat in? Anyone? Margarine. So it's going to be like the really bad fat that you're thinking. Trans fat. But that's another problem with these studies, is when they actually say polyunsaturated fat, there's trans fat, and I guess there's another type of fat that's polyunsaturated fat. I'm actually trying to look a little bit more into that. But again, these studies don't differentiate. They just kind of throw it all into a big pool. However, when I looked at only the case control studies, I saw a really different picture. None of the examined fats exhibited any significant association with breast cancer at all. Nothing. So that was kind of confusing. Now, I know that my study didn't show that there was a significant difference between women with premenopausal and postmenopausal breast cancer, but I kind of had a feeling that it did, so I went ahead and ran it. Turns out, if you look at postmenopausal women, both total fat and polyunsaturated fat had an increased risk of breast cancer. And if you look at the relative risk of breast cancer for diets that are high in polyunsaturated fat with premenopausal women, that number is 1.22. And if you remember, the other one was 1.06. So that's gone up quite a bit. If you look at premenopausal women, none of the fat types were significantly related to breast cancer. Instead, all of the fats, total, saturated, mono, and polyunsaturated, seem to have a protective effect against breast cancer. So if your RR value is below 1, that means it actually has a protective effect. Now, none of that was significant. I couldn't say that the trend was significant because my p-values weren't low enough, but that's what that says, which is very bizarre also. So in summary, I did see an association between breast cancer and risk of breast cancer risk and how much fat that a woman intakes. There was different types of relative risk for breast cancer that was observed among fat type. In the case control studies, total fat was significantly higher, and so was polyunsaturated fat. But remember, in the cohort studies, nothing was associated. And then also, in pre- and postmenopausal women, that was different too. Polyunsaturated fat produced a higher risk of breast cancer in postmenopausal women, where in premenopausal women, that actually had a protective effect. Yes. So, in a food, what a food? The question was, was the amount of fat that a woman intake determined? What a food frequency questionnaire is? It's the best type of what's called recall data, and recall data is problematic because you're asking someone to recall something and I can hardly recall what I did last week. So that's problematic. But what it does is it gives you a list of foods. So it doesn't just ask a woman whether or not whether or not she eats meat. It says, do you eat meat? And a woman would say yes or no. If it was yes, then it goes through a whole bunch of different things. Do you eat pork? Do you eat fish? Do you eat beef? Do you eat lamb? It goes through all of these. So they're really, really, really long. And that's how it's determined. And then there's a huge database that's actually in the U.S. government. And there's one through the World Health Organization. And you take that, those questions, you ask them about how much they eat a day. And then you have to go in by hand and then determine from how much they ate. And then it will give you an amount of fat per item. That's problematic. You can see the problems. It's the best way we have to do it right now. So that's another reason I only included studies that had food frequency questionnaires. So that's pretty much how they do it. They do, but the problem with that is that's not going to tell you relative risk of breast cancer because the women are already going to have breast cancer. There is the nurses study and the teachers study and the sisters study that will hopefully eventually do that, but it hasn't been going long enough for us to actually have a big enough sample size to say anything that's meaningful. Yes. See, that would have been, so the question was, other indicators such as body mass, body fat percentage actually included in the study? And some of them did. The problem was that I couldn't include it in my study because not enough of them did. Like, I think 4 did. So they seem to include them more in the studies that only looked at dairy. But the problem with the dairy studies is they section it out by food, so cheese, milk, stuff like that, not by fat type. And I wanted to look at fat type, I couldn't say, oh, well, if I include cheese, then this is this much polysaturated on fat. I don't know that information. That would be, you know, inappropriate for me to do, and it wouldn't tell us anything. So this is the summary of what I found. Now, there are problems with my, look, it changes color. I didn't even know that. That's amazing. All right, there are problems with my study. One is going to be statistics. And this is not just a problem with my study. This is a problem with meta-analysis in general. Okay, so the statistical method that I use is called the Gersimian layer method. It's really complicated, and I don't even understand it. That's why I bought a computer program. It's great. But what I do understand enough to know that what it does is it asks you to include certain variables. So it asks for the relative risk of the study and the confidence interval. And then it gives you an estimate of that relative risk. The problem, though, is when you have published studies, you're getting an estimate. So you're making an estimate of an estimate. And it's kind of like playing telephone, right? So if you start out at one table and you say something and then it goes all the way around, you have a completely different message at the end. And that's what happens here. So some of the information is actually lost in the statistics. There's also obviously a research bias toward postmenopausal women. I had a ton of different studies that looked at postmenopausal women, but I only had 7 that looked at premenopausal women. And then my big question is, I'm pretty confident when I would say that the effects of fat on your risk of breast cancer is not going to be consistent throughout life. What I want to look at is how does what a mother intakes during pregnancy affect the baby's relative risk of breast cancer? How does what you eat when you're an adolescent or growing up affect your relative risk of breast cancer? How does a woman who's had a child versus a woman who doesn't have a child affect risk of breast cancer? And then how does postmenopausal or premenopausal status affect risk of breast cancer? Also, there's not anything in any of these studies, not one of them, that actually addresses breast cancer type. So they lump DCIS, inflammatory, triple negative, they lump everything together and they say, that's breast cancer. Well, it's not, because breast cancer isn't one disease. It's many different types of diseases that we describe with this umbrella term because we really don't understand it enough. So for example, higher fat intake has been associated with ER and estrogen and progesterone positive breast cancers. However, higher fat intake has actually been negatively associated, so it has a protective effect on estrogen and progesterone negative tumors. So I'm doing this type of study for as what's called a pilot study for my dissertation. This is my fundamental research. I'm doing another one of these just like this with exercise load. So how does exercise affect relative risk of breast cancer? And I'm going to go through all of this again. But what I eventually want to do is I want to do a large cohort study on premenopausal women like all of you, and or at least you were. Sorry. I want to use food frequency questionnaires. And ask about dietary fat intake on subjects, their mothers, and their sisters. I want to know what you're currently eating. I want to know what you ate when you were a kid. And I want you to know what your mom ate while she was pregnant with you. Now, there's going to be a lot of problems with that. I know that because it's all recall data. But it's somewhere to start, right? So we have to start somewhere. Then I want to take all of your blood, and I want to contrast that with your estrogen levels. Remember in the beginning of my talk, I said that the more fat you intake, it increases the risk of breast cancer because it's actually affecting your estrogen levels, right? And so I want to see if women whose mom ate a lot of fat when they were pregnant, if their estrogen levels are higher now and they had breast cancer, if they ate a lot of fat during adolescence, if they're higher now. So I want to not only do the food frequency questionnaires, but I actually want to contrast that with actual hormonal levels and see if what everybody is hypothesizing is what we're actually observing. And then hopefully my research will then influence the clinical studies and the medical research that is being done. So thank you very much. Are there any other questions? How long will it take until I can start my larger cohort study? I am currently working on the exercise and breast cancer risk. I am hoping to have a proposal written and set into what's called the IRB. It's a review board, right, at IU by the end of November of this year. And that means that I can be funded because I want to get a lot of women involved in this. And I want premenopausal women. I want postmenopausal women. I want to take as many women as I have, and then I can sort it all out, right? So, because I've got to get grants to fly places, because I'd like to go to different YSC locations throughout America. And then I also have to hire a nurse to do all my blood draws. So hopefully, if I can get funded and I can get all my grants, I will start collection early in 2010. So the question was if I could use already existing databases like Friends for Life. I could. I would have to track all of those women down and then also their mothers and their sisters, which that could work. I'm trying to read a lot of different studies that basically assess the best way of going about this so that I can use my money most effectively and get the most women possible. So if I can figure out a way to make that work and have women actually respond to me. That's the problem. This all sounds like a really good idea in theory, but you have to get everybody to fill these stupid things out and then send them back into you and then give you blood draws. And then some people lie because people inherently lie, and then you have to weed all of that out. So, yeah. But that's definitely something that I will take into consideration. Do they? Well, great. I'll have to get that information immediately. Yes. So the question was, does a woman's estrogen levels vary throughout its cycle. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, yes, I would have, well, not they would ever for every woman. I would just have to make sure that the blood draws were taken at the same time of the ovulatory cycle for each woman. So, but that's a problem because you know what? That's why you have what are called confidence intervals, because your estrogen levels are going to be different right now than they were this morning because they vary over the day. They're going to be different depending on what you ate. They're going to be different whether or not you exercised today. They're going to be different on whether or not you made love to your husband today. So, but those type of fluctuations are actually built into the statistical programs, which is why I'm going to hire myself a statistician. Another thing to write into the grant. But yeah, they absolutely, and that's why you see all of these erectile dysfunction like drugs on television, because men are really easy. Women are such a pain to study because they fluctuate so much. So nobody wants to study women. Is there any other hormones or any other biological factors that could be looked at besides estrogen, because women who have had breast cancer may be on drugs that would influence that? That's a very good point. Now, with my study, I'm going to have to basically make sure that all of the women that are included are not on anything. You can look at some other things like progesterone, but that's going to be influenced. I'm going to have to make sure that women are not on birth control pills. I'm going to have to make sure that, which I won't really be that much of a problem for us, that women are not on any type of drug that would affect that. So that will obviously decrease my population that I'm looking at. But yeah. Yeah, so the question was, when I'm talking about premenopausal women, I'm including them in my study as premenopausal women at the time of diagnosis. And yes, that is correct. Another factor is that there's another category. There's not only premenopausal and postmenopausal. There's something called perimenopausal. And that's like when you're just about to go through menopause, but you're not quite there yet. And nobody really includes that in their studies either. So I'm trying to talk with some reproductive ecologists who study that kind of thing and see if that would be a problem in my study, if I should try to work that in, if it's not that big of a deal. So, yes, but that's exactly right. Am I going to go outside of the United States? Once I have my PhD and I have graduated, I would love to go outside of the United States. In fact, what I would really like to do is go to a society like Russia or China, or other societies that have really, really, women with really, really low body mass percentages, and see the prevalence of breast cancer. I can't really go to like the Kalahari Desert and look at the Kunsan because they have a really low risk of breast cancer because they can't diagnose breast cancer, right? I mean, so that's gonna be a problem. But there's in Russia and northern China, the women, there's a population of women who have really, really low body fat, and their breast cancer research, there's tons of stuff coming out of there. So I would like to go and contact them. Also, probably Japan has, the thing is, I need to find someplace that has a similar medical culture as the United States so that it can be a good comparison. That's the problem. You can't compare apples and oranges. Are they? I will definitely look into that. Yeah. Yeah. That's eventually where I want to go with this. I want to ask, you know, those types of questions that aren't being asked by the clinical studies because it's not worth their money. Like that's not their job, but it can ultimately, an anthropologist can ultimately ask these questions and do this research and then help to guide and then maybe save us some time and effort in finding cures for this problem. Well, thank you very much.